Turning this evening to the book of Daniel, chapter 1 and verse 12. Chapter 1 of the book of Daniel and verse 12. Prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. And our subject is the great test of faith. And we shall be looking at this first chapter of the book of Daniel. The book of the prophet Daniel makes a gentle start. It proceeds into depths of theology and prophecy and, of course, narrative concerning the proving of the Lord and his provision for his people. But it starts so beautifully and so gently. And here is the first chapter, so perfectly structured also from a literary point of view. Before we look into it properly, I just draw your attention to verse 3. Here are pivotal verses. And the king, that is the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes, noble youths, and he should bring them out of Jerusalem and to Babylon. So tragedy strikes a number of young men. And then in no time you find them elevated to a training course to serve in the emperor of Babylon's court. But verse 8 is another pivotal verse. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat. We'll come to it in a few moments, but in the narrative it's absolutely pivotal. But Daniel purposed in his heart he would take a tremendous risk, and risk humiliation and shame, and possibly even death, by not going along with what was required of him. And then the next pivotal verse is down in verse 17. As for these four children, or youths, would help us in our imagining of the scene. As for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. So you can see the chapter is structured around these three key verses. And you get them, you see the drift of the whole narrative. So we'll start at the beginning of the chapter, and this chapter will introduce us to the entire book and its wonders. And there are magnificent things in the book of Daniel. In fact, there's fresh Old Testament revelation touching on themes unseen in any earlier books in the Old Testament. You can't really study the theology of angels without the book of Daniel introducing new knowledge. You can't think very deeply about the doctrine of the resurrection of the body without the book of Daniel, which is the first clear, not the first announcement, but the first clear description of these things in the Old Testament. So to Daniel was given tremendous privileges of revelation, quite apart from this book demonstrating God's sovereign power to bless the survival of his people and their integrity through the ages. Well, we'll start at the beginning. Chapter 1 and verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Well, actually, he wasn't king of Babylon yet. Not for another year or so, but it's quite reasonable that Daniel should call him so, because this book is written after the death of Nebuchadnezzar and looks back at him as a great historic emperor king. So he is called a king here by way of a kind of prolepsis, anticipating all that There's no inaccuracy in the narrative. But this verse 1 goes back to 605 BC, the first of three attacks on Jerusalem. This first one by Nebuchadnezzar acting as a kind of prince regent for his father, representing his father. He'd taken an army down towards Egypt and now back, punishing Israel for her disobedience. And it's not a major attack, there's a siege. But I imagine that, realizing the purpose of Nebuchadnezzar, they opened the doors pretty quickly and let him in to chastise and bring to heel King Jehoiakim. And then he took treasures out of the temple and took them off to Shinar as kind of trophies. But what's significant to us, and that's recorded in verse 2, is this sentiment, this statement rather, in verse 3. The king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, described later as a prince, possibly even the first officer of state at the time in Babylon, that he should bring certain of the children or youths of Israel. Specifically, they would be of the king's seed, they'd be of royal blood, or children of princes, they would be noble youths. We don't know exactly how many there were, 5, 10, 15. The purpose of Nebuchadnezzar would be to have them, first of all, as trophies. His practice was to fill his court with the youngsters gathered out of his various conquered countries and train them and brainwash them and program them to be children of his empire and to be courtiers in court. They were kind of trophies of his conquests. So he wanted the very best, but also he would use them as regional governors and send them back to their lands in due course, having proved their loyalty to Babylon. And so they would be significant people, linchpins in his administration all over the empire. And although it's stated in few words here, in verse 4, children or youths in whom there was no blemish, they were no handicaps, no defects, but well-favoured, and the original rather indicates handsome, and that was possibly because the Babylonians thought that good looks were usually connected with good intelligence. It isn't so, but that was a belief in those days. And skillful in all wisdom, highly intelligent, able to handle wisdom, and cunning in knowledge, intelligent with things, understanding science. They had to pass various tests. I have no idea, of course, what tests, but it sounds as though there were rather sophisticated tests. Had a number of the noble children of Jerusalem and then subjected them to various examinations or whatever. And such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, whatever that might mean. There was a kind of poise about them, or a deportment by which they could say, this person is trainable to have authority, to be a diplomat, to be something in the king's service. Anyway, they seemed to know how they would pick them out, and they also had to have the capability of learning the tongue, that is, and the learning rather indicates learning to write, as well as to speak the tongue of the Chaldeans. And so Daniel was among these. And four, particularly, for the purposes of the book of Daniel, perhaps the most faithful to Jehovah, four are picked out, and their lives in some degree are followed. And verse 5, the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, the length of the course, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king, referring to the king's examination of them. They would be examined, no doubt, by their tutors, their teachers, But finally, the king wanted his own impression of them. He evidently considered himself to be a shrewd judge of character, and he possibly was. Now, among these, I'm sure you've read the book of Daniel and you're familiar with the narrative, and there they are named in verse 6. But how modestly Daniel puts this. You know, he is undoubtedly the author of the book of Daniel, the historical Daniel. And in the latter part of the book, on a number of occasions, he uses even the phrase, I, Daniel. I, Daniel. It's no doubt his book. Although he only begins to write in the first person in an autobiographical manner from chapter 7 on. It's almost as though, dare we say, Daniel could not bring himself to write in an autobiographical manner at the beginning of the book, because he's obliged to record as modestly as he can what might appear to be his own accomplishments. He ascribes them all to the Lord, but he avoids the first person until that's all over and done, and the scene is set, and only then does he speak in terms of his own experience. So Daniel, well, it's often said there is nothing bad recorded about Daniel, either in this book or anywhere else in the scripture, and is one of very few Bible characters of whom that can be said. The Lord, in the inspired word, didn't wish anything bad to be said about Daniel. He was a fallible person, as we are, but so great was his faithfulness that his reputation is preserved in every respect. But look down here at these names. I won't do the names, that will extend our thinking in verse 6, but I'll go on to verse 7, where they are given Chaldean names, all of which are connected with the name of a god. That's part of the process. Their minds must be changed. They must cease to be Israelites and become Babylonians in their outlook, their sense of identity. So they're given Babylonian names. And that was difficult to bear, to have to wear, as it were, the name of a Babylonian god when you are a sincere worshipper of the one true and living God, Jehovah. But there are the names in verse 7. And then we come to this pivotal verse. Up to this point, you can only imagine what this must have meant to these four young men, let alone the other Israelite youngsters, however many there may have been of them. But at first, horror, to be seized at the age of, 15 probably, some say a bit younger, 14, some say 17, even 18, but probably 15 or 16 at most, to be seized from Jerusalem, where they had, all of them I assume, been born and brought up from well-off families, noble families, people with some destiny, even in the fabric of the society of Israel, and then to just be seized away into the hand of the enemy, the overlord nation, the all-dominant Chaldean empire. For this to happen, a terrifying experience, and ups and downs, then to find when you're there that you have indeed been selected for a very grand purpose. You're going to be conditioned, you're going to be changed, you're going to be one day a high official, you're going to have a really intensive course of training. Well, I suppose if you were not faithful to Jehovah, you could brighten up and you could think, well, my fortunes have changed. I'm going to have luxury and influence and position. I'm not going to die. I'm going to serve the greatest emperor on earth, humanly speaking. I'm going to be able to do what I want, and as long as I'm obedient to the emperor and indulge myself. And here we are in the school attached to the royal court, the college, and we've got this tremendous fare to eat, the king's meat, the king's table, great grandness and pomp and so on. Well, this, things have turned out well. I can forget my home, I can forget Israel. You could think like that. If you were a worldly-minded youngster, you could think something quite tremendous. It's a bit of a struggle learning Chaldean and ancient Babylonian too, because we read on that they were going to have to be conversant in Babylonian literature. They were going to have, it would be quite a course of training, but they could think, my life has just gone up. I'm going to be really significant. And in the light of that, I suppose they talked to each other. They comforted each other considerably. Verse 8, but Daniel, and this is a great sentiment, but Daniel purposed in his heart. He had an inner vow that no matter what happened, he would not be unfaithful to the commandments of Jehovah. He would be faithful. But Daniel purposed, determined in his heart. That's something we so often fail to do. We have good intentions. We are going to serve the Lord. We're going to witness. We're going to do better in the coming year than we have perhaps in the past. We're going to be much more careful about certain things and much more watchful. But Daniel went a step further. He purposed in his heart. It indicates a real commitment and dedication and determination. That's what we all need. Not just to think we'll do this and we'll improve on that, but to form deep inner vows. I am going to honour the Lord in such and such. I'm going to honour the Lord in this objective. Well, Daniel made up his mind. The way it's put, although it's very modestly put, you rather, reading between the lines, get the impression that at first only Daniel was of this mind. The other three are not included in this. It seems to be only Daniel. But as you go down through the verses, us comes into the narrative, and the others seem to come on board and fall in step with Daniel. And that's often the case. One person has a holy, earnest, sincere, deep resolution, and others will be challenged, and others will join and make it their resolution also. Well, maybe the other Israelite youngsters didn't, but three went with Daniel, certainly, and they all seem to have joined in the same determination. Well, here is their experience. Verse 8, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat. And we ask, why? There were a number of things which he had cause to find pretty unbearable. Those names, those dreadful, dreadful names. To change, as it were, your Christian name for a pagan name, naming a god, a pagan god, each one a different one. That must have been highly objectionable and uncomfortable. You'd think that was bad enough. And then there was the indoctrination of the course. They were going to learn Babylonian, ancient Babylonian. They were going to learn the current Chaldean vernacular, yes. They would do maths. They would do astronomy. The Babylonians were very good at those. They would also do astrology and mythology, and they would find those subjects very undesirable, and they would be part of the brainwashing. They would have to learn the philosophy, the learning of the Chaldeans, but they could reject that. They could learn it so that they would be familiar with their environment and the society they were now part of, and better equipped to serve their own kingdom, Israel, the fortunes of the Israelites. But they wouldn't be breaking the law of God by learning those things. A burden to them, and objectionable, yes. They'd learn probably some agriculture and some architecture. I imagine a lot of things were in their course. Perhaps military studies, perhaps Chaldean law and social order, but the mythology was the worst. They would certainly have had to learn physical combat, and they may well have found that objectionable. They would be involved in fencing and riding and trekking and all sorts of things. And if you've been round the British Museum, you know that the Chaldeans absolutely loved, at least royalty did, lion hunting. And who knows what they would have been exposed to in the royal court. Frenzied and fantastic activity. Some people find the narrative about the food a little unrealistic, especially when we come to the verse where they're going to prove a vegetarian diet for 10 days, and people say, well, 10 days make a great deal of difference to them. Well, when you think of the regime they probably followed and the physical activity they were subjected to, as well as the intellectual side of things, well, yes, it would make a difference. Anyway, why pick on the food? Because the law of God forbade the eating of food which had been offered to idols. And every meal in the royal palace at Babylon was a kind of devotional act, an act of worship to the gods. All the food had been offered to the gods and would be right before their eyes. And that was transgressing a direct commandment of God. That was absolutely against the laws of Moses. So Daniel purposed in his heart, no, I'm not going to eat anything which has been offered to idols. Of course, a lot of the foods too would be foods forbidden under the laws of Israel. Foods that were regarded as unclean, designated as unclean. Daniel purposed in his heart. He could put up with some of the theoretical instruction because he'd dismiss it in his mind. He could defend himself against that, even the names, but not the eating of food offered to idols. So he takes a gigantic risk. He could be executed, or he could be taken off the course and sent among the slaves. All kinds of things could happen to him to humiliate him and debase him. But he purposed in his heart that no matter what it would cost, he would not break a commandment of the Lord. And the others came alongside him. And at first, immediately, because no doubt he prays, as you go through the book, he's a great man of prayer. And what happened was that God had already heard those prayers and already provided for him. Verse 9, now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs, that authoritative and hard man, as he would have been bound to be. Well, he had a soft spot for Daniel in particular. It was of the Lord. It was the Lord, no doubt, who had given him to notice certain the niceness in Daniel and his character and his honesty. And that made Daniel safe. And he approached him and asked if he could be excused, the king's meat. But the prince, he didn't dare do it. Verse 10, the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king. He's extraordinarily frank with Daniel. That wasn't the way of those times. Somebody who held high authority didn't explain himself to those who were under him. He didn't apologize to them. I'm very sorry, my dear chap, I can't do this for this reason. You didn't behave like that. You didn't lower your authority and give explanations. But this man is extraordinarily frank with Daniel. I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink, for why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort, the other children from Israel? Then shall ye make me endanger my head to the king. So the answer was no, couldn't be done. But it wasn't no in the sense the prince of the eunuchs who is over your instruction course says, no, you must eat the king's meat. It was only a limited no. No, because I fear the king, which left the way open for Daniel to approach another authority of lower rank who had no contact with the king, who wouldn't be answering to the king day by day. So verse 11, Daniel tries again, no doubt prayerfully, to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And he puts to him this proposal. He softened the request a little. Verse 12, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Then test it out. See if we're thinner and wasting under the rigours of this program with so much less to eat, or not the choice things that would otherwise be available to us. Verse 14, he consented to them in this matter and proved them 10 days. Then at the end of the 10 days, you know the record, it's there in verse 15, they were obviously these boys, carrying more muscle and flesh than the other children who had been partakers of the portion of the king's meat. And so verse 16, Melzar lets that be a permanent arrangement for them. So they pass the test, the great test of faith. It's a test of faith for everyone who's a believer in Christ. Early on in the Christian life, at intervals afterwards, here's some great test of faith will come. We're not likely to stand if we're not resolved in our hearts to obey the Lord no matter what and to serve him no matter what. If I should be a limpid sort of Christian, when the test comes, I'll fall all the more easily and quickly. And this was a massive test. So it's an up and down situation. Seized, taken away into captivity. Suddenly discovering they've got tremendous opportunities before them if they can only accommodate themselves to being in the service of Babylon. Then, for those who are the godly ones, a tremendous risk. Obey the Lord and risk humiliation or even death. And they come through. And then, to summarize the first chapter, we go directly to verse 17. As for these four youths, God gave them. Isn't it beautiful the way that Daniel writes it? Look back just for a moment, because I'm just telling you this. Look at verse 6. Here is Daniel, under inspiration, but writing about his background. Now among these were of the children of Judah. That's all he's got to say about himself. How did you start out, Daniel? Nebuchadnezzar was rounding up nobles' kids. Who were you the child of? He doesn't tell us. Not a word. He's not going to tell us his background. He's not going to tell us his breeding, his accomplishments in youth or his opportunities. He limits his narrative. Now among these were of the children of Judah. That's beautiful, isn't it? Oh, that every Christian person would be so modest as Daniel and so reluctant to say anything that would colour your view of him or inflate his reputation. And he's doing the same thing in verse 17. As for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. He was given the great privilege of prophetic office even as a teenager, even as a youth, and had insights and revelations, dreams. Why, at those tender years, he was the kind of pastor of the church in Babylon, the underground church in the palace, and probably not so underground because of Daniel's boldness. And he'd learned a great deal as a youth back in Jerusalem. He had the scriptures, but now God gives him much more than all that, and even prophetic understanding. But they had learning and wisdom, and they were advanced. But it's all assigned to God. Amazing the progress they made. Verse 18, now at the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king communed with them. I used to think, or get a mental picture of him walking about among them in this reception hall. But then I realized that was absurd. The emperor of Babylon would never have walked around among these youths who were just graduating in his college for courtiers. He would never have done that. They never left their thrones, those kings. You always had to lick the dust before them, and they remained on their elevated thrones. This was all directed from a throne, dear friends. But the king loved to ask hard questions. He had a great reservoir of them in his mind. He seems to have excelled at this, and he would bark out his questions that had stumped every youth before and stumped all the wise men of among the Chaldeans, which they never gave satisfactory solutions to. And he'd look at one young man and he would boom out, what if you were, I'm making this up, what if you were a regional governor and people came to you for justice and this was the situation? And out would come the hard problem. What would you do? And people would stutter and stammer and say, well, sir, I suppose the best thing to do would be this or that. No, no, no. But these four, schooled in Moses and the law of Moses, trained to think from the scriptures, given also special blessing and power and enabling by God, they were clear in their thinking, and they worked these problems out, and they gave good and sound answers. Answers so sensible and intelligent and just that they exceeded what would normally come to the king from his wise men, his astrologers, and so on. And that's what the narrative tells us. Then the king communed with them, and he threw out his hard questions, and back came sound answers. There were none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king, which is a way of describing they were graduated. And they stood with whatever documents may have attended that ceremony. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better. If you've got a marginal reference in your Bible, you'll find the Hebrew says 10 hands better. And nobody quite knows what that means. But it may be rather literal. Maybe they had to put their hands up if they had an answer. And the fastest hands were always these four. Maybe it's not a mathematical thing, 10 times better. But I suppose in this day of interminable TV quizzes, you'd say they were the fastest on the buzzer every time. They had an answer. and a sensible answer, and a deep and a profound answer. So anyway, whatever it means, he found them 10 hands better, or 10 times better, than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. And then the concluding verse of the chapter, and Daniel continued, he lived, even unto the first year of King Cyrus. Well, we know from this book he lived beyond that. By how long? Well, at least 2-3 years. There's not a defect in the narrative here. It's just that the first year of King Cyrus was a most astonishingly significant year, because it was the year of the Cyrus Edict and the year proclaiming the return of the captives. The 70-year captivity would come to an end, and Cyrus would declare religious freedom. And although we've no right to say so or to speculate, because the senior officer of state in the civil service of Cyrus was still Daniel, who'd gone through these dynasties, these reigns, and was still there over 70 years in Babylon, I think we're entitled to feel that maybe Daniel drafted the Cyrus Edict. Who knows? There it sits in the British Museum. You can see it. That great historic tablet, astonishing, the proclamation of liberty, nothing like it in history before. A pagan king moved by God to do such a thing, unheard of, in the interests of his people. But with Daniel in the shadows there in the court, you wonder if he had been the drafting agent. But who knows? That's in a single chapter. Captive, suddenly given the opportunity, the potential, have power and wealth and so on in the service of the Chaldeans, took a great stand for the truth and for the faith, and elevated to be the most prominent person. And his service meant, of course, he was a prophet. He prophesied uniquely as a prophet of the 4 great world empires that lay before him until the coming of the kingdom of Christ. He prophesies of the church of Jesus Christ. I've already mentioned his disclosure of the resurrection of the body. And he sets a tremendous example of piety, and someone who God has raised up and put in a position really for the benefit of the remnant of his people, to secure their safety and their future and the coming of the promised seed. This is the book of Daniel, dear friends. There's so much in it for us to look at, but I'd like to mention just one or two more things quickly before we close. And, well, verse 18 and 19, we've looked at that, but no compromise, nothing is trivial to Daniel when it's the law of God. Some people would think so. I think this whole book starts and pivots around refusing to eat certain foodstuffs, laws which were to be done away with the coming of Christ anyway, laws which would be obsolete before many centuries had passed. This seems to be almost religious fanaticism, to stake your life and your position and any good you might be able to do. And I wonder if these 4 young men discuss this. But look, Daniel, surely we've been put here for a purpose. We could be very significant for the children of Israel in the service of Babylon. So if we just yield at this point, it's only foodstuffs. It's not a moral matter. It's not a profound, a deep matter, surely. Isn't it a rather secondary matter, what you eat? These are from the food laws of God, which are just to teach principles. All right, we've got the principles, but we can bend the letter of the law just now in order to preserve our position and our opportunities for the future. We're still free to worship and so on. But no, said Daniel, it's a breach of the law of God which binds us at the present time. It's what God requires of us. We've to honour him. And he stood. But there were a lot of arguments which could be advanced, that the Lord would bless you, you'll do much good. It's only a small thing and a non-moral thing which you have to bend. But they were to discover that the Lord would use them through their obedience and their sincerity and their truthfulness. And it's the same today. There's a lot of bending of God's laws. There's a lot of things, as I'm constantly saying, going on even among Bible believers today that are against the law of God. We hear a lot about the so-called New Calvinism. What is New Calvinism? Well, it's a sudden fashion to adopt the doctrines of grace and the doctrines of the Reformation while not taking on board the moral obligations and all the duties. And so those people who would call themselves new Calvinists, there are all kinds of things they let slip, they put to one side. They don't want to obey on. They want to relax the rules of the Christian life and the rules of Scripture and call it unnecessary or secondary or even legalism, dear friends. But the Lord won't greatly use them. And he'll warn them. He'll warn them. But the outcome will be bad. Because this chapter 1, book of Daniel, who's used? The people who would not compromise, resulting in disobedience to God. The people who purposed in their hearts and were truthful before the Lord, who touch not the unclean thing. And we have to leave worldliness well alone. Friendship with the world is enmity with God, and we note that. We'll accept the penalties and the difficulties and the derision, and God will use us and bless us. We proceed by faith. That's the book of Daniel, but it's just chapter 1. And it opens up into so many marvellous things. Will there be a great test for you this week? Will you stand? Will you fall? As the years have gone by, I've seen a lot of young people come and go. People with great promise. Teens, older teens, early 20s. What will happen to them? Will they stand? Will they be significant in the Lord's service? Will they be fruitful for him? And whether they stand or whether they fall is all to do with this, faithfulness to the Lord. Will they go into the world and be absorbed by that and be of no great consequence, even if they're truly saved? How will they proceed? The secret is all here in Daniel chapter 1. That's where it starts. The massive test. And he stood. And some others stood with him. And were they blessed? 70 years in the prophetic office in an alien land. Astonishing. Let's close, dear friends, singing the hymn number 450.